Hello, this is Richard Davis, welcoming you to At Home This Morning, our magazine programme for older listeners, which we hope will also be of interest to the not-so-old. And you'll be pleased to hear that we're hardly going to mention the coronavirus at all. We're going to be talking about some much more cheerful subjects. To start off with, I'll be talking to the author of a new book about the work of the World War II codebreakers at Bletchley Park, and telling you how you can get hold of a copy. Then we'll be looking at an imaginative scheme started by the Martlets Hospice to provide support and counselling for recently bereaved men. We'll also be hearing about a daily wildlife blog that's been set up by the Sussex Wildlife Trust. And finally, we'll be talking to a man who's produced some rainbow T-shirts in support of the NHS. They're the ideal thing to wear when you're out applauding the NHS on a Thursday evening. As usual, we're giving out various phone numbers, email addresses and website addresses during the course of the programme, so you may like to have a pencil and paper handy so that you can write them down. Well, I don't know about you, but I've always been fascinated by the work carried out by the codebreakers at Bletchley Park during the Second World War. So I was interested to receive a press release saying that a new book on the subject had been published. The book was written by Dermot Turing, who's the nephew of Alan Turing, probably the best known of all the codebreakers. To find out more, I spoke to Dermot Turing on the phone, and I began by asking him why he thinks people are so fascinated with Bletchley Park.
I think a combination of things. First of all, I think the imagination of the nation was captured by the whole idea that a very significant World War II secret had been kept secret for so long, and what's more, that it was a secret that showed a whole load of ingenuity and panache and, you know, a bunch of things that, frankly, British people can take a lot of pride in. And ever since the news first broke in the 1970s, I think that's been very important. It kind of changed the narrative about World War II in a way that actually made Britain look really quite good at a time when Britain was feeling pretty rotten about itself. So that, I think, has sort of embedded importance of what happened at Bletchley Park into the national psyche. But I think there's a bit more than that. There's a number of human or geographical interest stories that have enhanced that. First of all, there's, of course, the story about Alan Turing, which I'm sure you're going to want to talk about, and his own personal life story, and the fact that was made into this movie starring Benedict Cumberbatch. You know, that obviously very popular and piqued a lot of interest among a section of the community who hadn't really thought about or known about Bletchley Park before. But then there's something else, which is also the geographical thing, which is the story of saving Bletchley Park, the idea that Bletchley Park was going to be bulldozed to make way for an out-of-town shopping centre when those things were fashionable. And a intrepid bunch of local folks managed to save the place. And I think that those things all have a romantic appeal to them.
Now, there have been several books written about Bletchley Park in recent years. Some of them were by people who actually worked there. Why did you think another book was necessary?
It's quite interesting. When you look at the books that were written by the folks who worked there, they tend to talk about what they did. That's fine, and that's all very interesting. What they are more reticent about is who they were. They don't write about themselves. They push themselves as characters, as human beings, sort of into the background a bit. Sometimes they write about their colleagues, and typically what you'll find out about the colleagues is how eccentric or peculiar they were, and that's quite fun. But very rarely does the interests or background or the character of the actual writer come out. There's some great books that were written sort of 20-odd years ago, which contain chapters written by various people who served at Bletchley Park. And those are great, but as I say, they are a bit two-dimensional in the sense that they don't really bring out anything about the writer themselves. I mean, let me give you an example. Joan Clarke, who was briefly engaged to Alan Turing and one of the handful of female mathematicians who was allowed to do code-breaking at Bletchley Park, she wrote a chapter in one of these books about her own experiences, and she says absolutely nothing about herself. She says nothing about her career. She says nothing about any of her personal circumstances at all. She certainly doesn't mention the engagement to Alan Turing. She writes just half a dozen pages on the sort of technical stuff that she did and what life was like in the hut where she worked. You know, I mean, it's good stuff. It's entertaining. It's fun. But wouldn't it have been so much better if it had been 400 pages where she'd gone into everything else? What I wanted to do is to fill in the gap. We've got all these accounts by the codebreakers, but not really anything about them. There's a bit of a challenge if you want to write that kind of thing, because you know, I can't imagine anything more tedious than picking up a book and then discovering that pages, you know, 1 to 5 are about John Tiltman, and pages sort of 6 to 10 are about Joan Clarke, and pages 11 to 15 are about Alan Turing. And by the time you've got to page 15, then you're fast asleep, I should think. So you need to have some kind of binding narrative to hold it together. But that's easy to do with a subject like Bletchley Park, because the thing has its natural beginning and end, and the importance of the different characters is manifested at different points in the storylines. So it's actually quite easy to bring their life stories into the general narrative in that way. So I hope it doesn't come across as just sort of effectively a biographical dictionary, because that would be ghastly if it does.
No, not at all. I think it's a very good balance between the history, i.e. what was going on, and the people, and with sufficient technical information to keep the technically minded reader interested. And I really like the way that you've included little potted biographies of the various characters actually in the text wherever they first appear.
Yeah, that was sort of what I wanted to do. And again, perhaps if there's a self-criticism there are some characters who probably merit an entire full-length biographical treatment in their own right, and so I think it's perhaps disappointing that the format doesn't really allow you to write more than a page or two about any of these people. And some of them are really very interesting indeed. Not all of them packed with thrill-a-minute kind of stuff that you get with the story of Alan Turing, but there's some pretty powerful, impressive, interesting people there. And from a wide range of different interests and backgrounds and careers. That's one of the most extraordinary things about Bletchley Park, is that it attracted all these different types of people, and they all seem to have a role there. Very, very interesting.
And for the most part, they seem to have managed to work together, although obviously you've mentioned some frictions between them.
Yes, some of the lipstick on the Bletchley Park story has wiped off over the years. I mean, you know, we were all led to believe that everything was wonderful and hunky-dory, and everybody got on like a house on fire. So lots of professors sitting around the fire and smoking their pipes. That isn't quite how it was, and there were definitely some tensions between the military and the academic communities. There were definitely some tensions within the armed services about who should have priority and predominance.
For various reasons, Alan Turing is by far the best known person to have worked at Bletchley Park, partly due to the tragedy of his personal life, of course. I get the impression that in this book you seem to have been at pains to remove him from his plinth as being the one and only genius that there was there, and point out that he was just one of many brilliant people who were working there. For example, you point out shortcomings of the mechanical computer that he produced, which for various reasons that I won't go into was known as the bomb, and that it only really became a success after it had been modified by one of his colleagues, Gordon Welshman.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Sometimes it annoys me, and it annoys others, actually, that somehow Bletchley Park is associated with one man's name, and that's wrong for so many reasons. We can inquire about why the popular imagination requires narratives to have single heroes rather than teamwork, and we can also inquire about why the Enigma story in particular has somehow crowded out all the other code-breaking activities that took place at Bletchley Park. Enigma may have been the most significant. I can't tell you whether it was. We do know that a vast amount of intelligence did not derive from Enigma, and therefore it's not right that Enigma should somehow steal all the limelight. I think these two factors, Alan Turing's life story and the fact that somehow we've got it into our heads that Enigma was the only thing that mattered, these things have sort of pushed Alan Turing right to the front of the story. And it's kind of not fair, and not just because it leaves the other folks out of consideration, but also because Alan Turing wasn't a Bletchley Park for the whole of the war. People will be astonished to discover that, because that's not what we believe from popular narrative. After 1942, he went to work at a different establishment called Hanslet Park, about 10 miles north of Bletchley. And he was working on a radio telephone device for the remainder of the war. Although he was still peripherally involved at Bletchley, he wasn't doing code-breaking stuff anymore. It's about half the war that we're talking about.
Yes, but I suppose it's a complicated story and you have to simplify it a bit to make it digestible by the general public, don't you?
Yeah, well, I think that's right, and therefore things get simplified. And also, there's a feeling that, well, stories aren't exciting unless they're presented in fairly single-dimensional terms.
As you mentioned earlier, Alan Turing's story has been made into a film recently called The Imitation Game, which I gather is a phrase that he himself coined in a different context. What do you think of the film?
I think you have to look at it in two ways. First of all, if you are asking, is it a good movie, should I go and watch it, will I have a great evening watching a movie, the answer is an unqualified yes. It's a cracker of a movie, and it's got great actors, got a great plot line, and I would say it's done an absolutely splendid thing for Bletchley Park Trust, in that what it's done is drawn to the movie-going public their attention to something they didn't know about, and so people want to go and visit Bletchley Park and find out what really happened in the place that it happened for themselves. So, great. I mean, three cheers all round. If you approach it as somebody sitting to watch a history documentary, there are so many things wrong with it, it's difficult to know where to begin. So all I would just do is urge people who are going to watch it, and it's a great movie, so do go watch it if you haven't done, not to treat it as a piece of history. It's not far off in most of the themes that it tackles, but things happen in the wrong order, the wrong people are involved, the characters are portrayed in ways that is not faithful to how they were in real life, etc., etc., etc. So it would sound just grumpy if I were to give you a catalogue of those things, but that's the overall message, is it's a great movie, it's not great history.
Now, the current situation has made things a bit difficult, really. The book was due to be published on June the 1st, wasn't it? But is it still likely to come out then, or is it going to be a delay, do you think?
No, I think rather the reverse. We were planning to try and hold some events and make a bit of a song and dance about it. Obviously, with the lockdown situation, it's too difficult to plan that kind of thing with any certainty. So I suspect the beginning of June we may still be struggling a bit. So what we decided to do instead was actually say, well, we've got the books, they're already printed, so there's no reason to hold them back to June now, so why don't we let them out early? So that's what's happening. So that means that people can actually get hold of the books right now.
So it's a case of contacting your favourite bookseller, and obviously the bigger ones should have it in stock.
And obviously these days when people can't actually go out shopping for anything other than essentials, then your favourite bookseller may be an online provider.
Quite likely.
I know that most of the larger chains have their own websites, and will be happy to no doubt arrange deliveries without people actually physically visiting their stores.
Thank heavens for mail order and the internet. Okay, well, thanks very much, Dermot.
Thank you.
I was talking to Dermot Turing about his new book on the subject of the Codebreakers. And as he said, the book is now available. It was originally going to be published on June the 1st, but in the current circumstances, they've brought the publication time forward. So if you look on the website of your favourite bookshop, you should find that it's available. Just to remind you, the book is called The Codebreakers of Bletchley Park, and it's written by Dermot Turing. Now, just recently, I picked up a leaflet describing a scheme called Earthworks, which is run by the Martlets Hospice. Apparently, it's a way of providing support and counselling for recently bereaved men. about getting everyone together to dig in an allotment. Well, I had intended to go over to the Martlets, see the scheme in action, and talk to some of the participants. But unfortunately, the coronavirus lockdown put paid to that idea. So instead, I spoke to the scheme's organiser, Katie Dennis, on the phone. And I began by asking her whose idea the scheme was.
At the hospice, we offer bereavement support. And what had been noticed was that a smaller percentage of men were accessing the bereavement support. We looked at potential ways of men accessing our support, and it was thought that a group would be a good idea. And then we looked at possibilities of groups, and we looked at things like the healing power of nature. And the manager at the time, that's Jane Cato, had worked previously on allotment type projects and thought this would be a fantastic idea for us to do something like that, Martlets. And so the project was born, and we didn't have our own allotment, so we were able to access another community garden called Plot 22 at the Weald allotments, and we ran a pilot project there which was really successful. And then from that we were able to get our own allotment at the Weald, which we now run, which is fantastic.
And that allotment is actually next door to the hospice, isn't it?
It's really close, yes. It's the Weald allotments are it's a large group of allotments. I think there's over 300 there. And it's very close to the hospice, a couple of minutes' walk. So you can access it from the side gate. And we are number 98. That's our plot. Very proud of it.
So when did it start?
Well, we started the project last year on plot 22, so we ran that in partnership with them, and it was very successful. And then we got our own allotment for Martlets, and it was a real mess. So we had to strip it all down and sort everything out, put fences in, get a cabin. And then the first group started in November of last year, and they had 12 sessions, which ran up until February. And then the second group started in February. And we offer a weekly session for 3 hours. And the first group was in the afternoon, and the second group started in the morning. And then we're going to alternate it, so we'll have an evening group and then a Saturday group at some point in the future.
I presume the COVID virus problem has interfered with this plan somewhat.
It really has. We had to stop all group activities at the hospice because of the COVID virus. And so the allotment project was stopped, which was a real shame because the second group had only just started and it was proving to be a really successful resource for them. So what I'm doing instead at the moment is offering a weekly support call to each member of the group at around the time we would have had our 3 hours on the allotment to see how they are, check in with them, any updates, and just to know that they're not on their own, they're still part of the group. And I'll do that each week over the 12 sessions that we would have had.
So what happens in a typical session?
In a typical earthwork session, everybody arrives. I meet everybody at the gate because it's a locked gate allotment site, and then we go up to the allotment and we start off with a cup of tea and a catch-up, see how everybody is, a check-in, really, to see how people are. And that gives me an opportunity to gauge who I might need to work with individually or who might need a bit of extra support from me that day. And then we have a list of tasks that we have to do. So there's lots of work. There might be painting. There could be planting. There could be weeding. That's the job nobody likes to do. So we'll work out who'd like to do what. And we do have a little wood burner in the cabin where we meet, and we need to keep that going. So somebody might chop some wood up and keep an eye on the wood burner. And then everyone goes about their tasks, and then I'll move around the group and conversations will come up. People will talk about what they want to talk about. They want to share things. It's a really good, safe space to be able to explore really difficult thoughts and feelings with a group of like-minded people who understand where you're coming from. Or not, you might just want to do a bit of gardening and just be in the outdoors. So it's really flexible opportunity to just be in the outdoors with the healing power of nature.
Right, and there are different types of work to suit different individuals.
Absolutely. We're not expecting anybody to have any gardening experience. If people have, that's fantastic, but you don't have to. And there are a range of different jobs that people can do. If somebody may not be able to stand for too long, they can have a job where they might be seated and they might be planting things or working at a table. Somebody else who may be more than able to do some more complicated work can do that. And if you just wanted to sit in the sunshine, you can do that if it is sunshiny.
You were saying that you wander around and talk to the members. Is there any professional psychological or bereavement help available at these sessions?
This is a therapeutic space and I'm a trained counsellor. So there is always an opportunity to explore difficult feelings with me from a therapeutic perspective. So yes, there is psychological support available.
But presumably a lot of the help comes from the members simply talking to each other.
It does. I think being able to share things within a group of people who have an understanding of your feelings makes a big difference. And sometimes people don't want to sit in a one-to-one situation exploring things with a counsellor. They want to do that, but in a more of a sort of open therapeutic space. And that's what we can offer.
Is the project open to any bereaved men in the Brighton area, or is it just people whose relatives have been looked after by Martlets?
Earthworks Project is open to any bereaved men in the Brighton and Hove and surrounding area. It's the first time we've been able to open our doors to people who have bereavement who haven't been supported by Martlets. So, yes, it's open to all. We have referrals from GPs. We have people who contact us because they've seen pieces in magazines. We're branching out to as many men as we can in the area.
And does this mean you're going to have to run more groups in future?
Yes, I hope so. I really do hope that we'll be able to run more groups in the future. I mean, it's a wonderful resource having an allotment. And, of course, the more groups we've got on there, the more people can keep an eye on things and the more the allotment itself will grow. So that will be fantastic.
Is this group only for men?
At the moment, we only have a men's group on the allotment because that was the real need that we had at Martlets, to offer something for men. In the future, we'd like to open it up to lots of different groups. So we'd like to have a carers group. We'd like to have a group for patients. We'd like to have all sorts of different groups. That's the hope for the future of the allotment.
Do you run any other social activities for the members, non-gardening ones?
We have a monthly bereavement social group. That is for people who've had a loved one cared for by the Martlets. And that's a monthly group where people can meet, and that's open to men and women. At the beginning, a speaker comes. Somebody comes along to talk about something that maybe they're a maker, or they might have a local interest, or they might be a historian, and they'll talk to the group. And then afterwards, it's a social group where people can meet and have cups of tea and cake and chat. And then we have lots of day services at the hospice, which aren't social activities. They're separate. But at the moment on the allotment, we just have the one group, but we're looking to expand.
Now, is there any charge for being a member of these groups?
No, there's no charge at all. The services at Martlets are free to access. That includes the counselling bereavement service. We don't have a charge for any of those services at all.
But you're happy to receive donations, presumably?
Martlets is a charity and we're always happy to receive the generous donations that we get from people. We're very, very lucky.
How long do people tend to stay with the group?
The Earthworks group runs for 12 sessions, and the first group has been through, and everybody stayed for the whole 12 sessions, so they really valued coming each week. And this group that we only just started, unfortunately had to stop because of the COVID, again, we have capacity of 8, so we had 7 people in that group, and they were coming every week as well. So it's very well attended, and people really enjoy it.
Presumably, once somebody's completed the 12 sessions, they can't then go on and join the next group.
how it initially works is people can come for 12 sessions, and once they finish those 12 sessions, if that's the amount of therapeutic work that they needed, then they don't need to come for the next. If, however, there's something that they might still need to work with, then they might come to the next 12 as well. But the maximum would be for the two lots of 12, really.
What's happening to the allotment while you're unable to get to it?
Well, I'm doing my best to try and keep on top of things at the allotment, watering-wise and weeding-wise. I also have my own allotment on the allotment group, so I'm going up whenever I can. In fact, we had a delivery of perennial plants that arrived yesterday at the hospice, and I had to go and collect those and bring them over to the allotment. I was hoping to divert them somewhere, but they ended up there, but I've got them. So I'm going to plant those this afternoon, in fact, after I've finished talking to you. So I'm just trying to keep on top of things as long as I can up there when I have the time. So that hopefully when we start again later on in the year, fingers crossed, everything will be in a good place for everyone to come back to.
Now, you have a group in place at the moment which isn't functioning because of the virus problems, but it will start up again later in the year. When are you next starting a new group, if people listening would like to actually join one?
We're not sure when we're going to be taking on another group, but we will be. And if people are interested, if they want to email me at the hospice, then I can send out some information to them to let them know what the group's all about, if they have any questions. And then once we are going to start up a new group again, I can be in contact with people.
And what's your email address?
My email address is katie@martlets.org.uk.
Okay, thanks, Katie.
You're very welcome. Take care now.
And
stay
you.
Well.
Bye.
Bye now.
I was talking to Katie Dennis of the Martlets Hospice about their earthworks scheme. If you'd like to find out more, you can contact Katie by email, and her email address is katie.dennis@martlets.org.uk. That's katie.dennis@martlets.org.uk. And if you don't have access to the internet, you can phone the hospice on Brighton 273400. That's 01273 273400. And by the way, I'm still intending, once the coronavirus crisis has passed over, to go over to the Martlets Hospice, see the earthworks scheme in action, and talk to some of the participants. So watch, or rather listen to, this space. Well, despite the current problems, there are still some pleasant things going on. Here's Maya Davis to tell us about one of them.
Since the 18th of March, Michael Blenko of the Sussex Wildlife Trust has been posting a daily podcast diary on the Trust's website. He writes, "With the world shut down around us, the uplifting role that wildlife plays in our lives becomes more vital than ever. So, for my own sanity as much as anything, I'm going to keep a daily diary of what I find around my garden. Photograph the wildlife you can see from your window or in your garden and post your pictures on the Sussex Wildlife Trust Nature Table page. You can find Michael's podcast at sussexwildlifetrust.org.uk/news/corona-wildlife-diary-day-1, and 1 is written out as a word, not a number. Sussex Wildlife Trust is all one word. Well, that link will take you to the first day's entry in the diary, and you can then move on to subsequent days from there.
Thanks, Maya. I'll just give the address of that wildlife diary again. It's at Sussex Wildlife Trust, which is typed all as one word with no spaces, .org.uk/news/corona-wildlife-diary-day-1. day-1. Not forgetting that the 1 on the end there is spelt O-N-E and not typed as a figure. That'll give you the first day of the diary, which was issued on the 18th of March, and from there you can find the other more up-to-date pages. Well now, here's some information about another way that people have found to make the best of the current situation. Here's Chris English to tell us more.
If you're a family that joins your neighbours at your front doors, your balconies or your garden gates every Thursday evening at 8 o'clock to join in with the Clap for Carers campaign, this next item could be right up your street. Excuse the pun. Because we're pleased to welcome now on the telephone David Zarzecki, who is the founder of the Rainbow Thank You NHS T-shirt campaign. Good morning, David, and welcome to At Home This Morning. First, can you please explain where the whole idea came from?
Hi, Chris. The idea was born with through a conversation I'd had initially with Anne-Marie Plaz, who's the founder of Clap for Our Carers. We were having a discussion about something slightly different with ourselves at Kindred. And I went away that evening and thought, well, there must be more that we can do to help support this incredible sort of clapping revolution that's going on throughout the UK and the world. And I had this epiphanic moment and I thought, well, perhaps a T-shirt campaign to help support this and support the NHS charities together would work. So we collaborated, designed a T-shirt, and we then sent it out to a handful of celebrities and influencers, and it's just snowballed beautifully.
What is Kindred? Because you mentioned that just now.
So Kindred is a social enterprise whereby we effectively connect brands to consumers. So when a consumer makes a purchase on Kindred and they find an offer or a discount that they like, they can do one of two things. One, they can buy it, but they can also share it through our sharing tool, which allows them to amplify the brand's message, the brand's offer to the consumer's friends, family and social followers. But when the consumer purchases, they receive cash back, and a minimum of 1% of their cash back will go to the consumer's charity of their choice. But they can also then decide if they want to increase that charitable donation from 25%, 50% or to 100% to their chosen charity. So effectively, every time someone buys something on Kindred, a charity wins. So our ultimate aim is to become the largest corporate charitable donor in the world.
I mean, that's amazing, and more power to your elbow with that. Have you got an idea how much cash you've raised so far?
Yeah, so as of Monday, we've raised £250,000, and we hope by the end of the week we will raise hopefully just over £1 million, with obviously the ultimate goal to raise over £5 million. If we surpass that, then that would be simply incredible.
I mean, it's amazing. We've heard about the efforts of Captain Tom and raising money for the NHS. Amazing amount of money that is being raised for not only the health service itself, but the charities that are involved with it. Do you echo all of that?
I do. I'm in absolute awe of Captain Tom Moore. I think what he's done is simply brilliant. And he should be super proud. He should be knighted. And I think, you know, his efforts and to do, you know, to be dedicated to this cause is wonderful. We actually sent Captain Tom Moore a T-shirt to sort of thank him for his brilliant efforts. And he's a great man, and I hold him in utter regard.
Other than Captain Tom, some of the T-shirts have been worn by celebrities. Are they available to buy?
Yeah, no, you can buy the T-shirts. So the ones that the celebrities have are the ones that we're selling through www.kindred.co. And anyone can go on and buy a T-shirt. We've got a couple of different designs on there, but the rainbow design is certainly the one that seems to be most popular at the moment and trending. And anybody can go on. We have a few ideas that we'll be doing shortly. We're trying to get a designer behind this to design another similar T-shirt that we're going to be launching in the next few weeks. But we're also doing something whereby we're encouraging people to buy a T-shirt for someone they know who works for the NHS or who's a carer. So, and that'll be implemented hopefully within the next week or so onto Kindred. But yeah, so you know, our sort of message is buy, wear, and share, and share being, you know, when you've got your T-shirt, model it, take a photo of it, take a video of it, and share it on your social media pages, and I hope to encourage all your friends and family to jump on and buy one in support of NHS charities together.
That's wonderful. What prompted you to get involved in this whole NHS fundraising business?
I think as a company, because we are sort of very much at the forefront of what we do is about charity, and given the current situation that we're in, you know, we needed to diversify slightly in the sense of what could we do to really support the NHS, and given the fact that I think the NHS charities have over 300 NHS charities they support, it made total sense to get behind this, and that was also the charity that Anne-Marie from Clap for Our Carers wanted to support too. So that's why we collaborated and decided to drive this forward, and it seems to be sort of doing rather well now.
Finally, how important is it that we all still go outside on a Thursday evening at 8 o'clock and just clap our hands for the NHS and the carers and all the emergency services?
I think it's super important. I think it unites us as a nation, it's a small way that we can say thank you to their incredible efforts for risking their lives for us. You know, my condolences go out to those that have lost their lives and the families who have lost loved ones. It's tragic, and I look at the news every day, and it breaks my heart. But I think if we can try and bring a joyous side to this and get behind the NHS and wear our T-shirts with pride and support a brilliant cause and support these incredible doctors and nurses and carers, then I think, you know, we should be banging pans and clapping our hands and really getting behind this. So for everybody, please obviously stay on your drives, don't sort of wander down the street, but so stay safe, but you know, let's get the nation to continually support this at 8 o'clock every Thursday, and that would be wonderful.
David, thanks very much for joining us, and keep safe.
Thank you so much. Have a lovely day.
Chris English was talking to David Zarzecki of Kindred about their Clap for Our Carers T-shirts. The T-shirts are available from their website, which is www.kindred.co. That's www.kindred.co. And the prices are £20 for an adult T-shirt or £15 for a child's T-shirt. And 100% of the money goes to the NHS. Well, that item brings to an end this edition of At Home This Morning, our magazine programme for older listeners, which we hope will also have been of interest to the not-so-old. There'll be another edition in a fortnight's time, and that'll be presented by Chris English. And I'll be back with you with another edition in 4 weeks' time. But in the meantime, it just remains for me, Richard Davis, on behalf of Grey Matters Productions, who are the group who produce this programme for Radio Reverb, to thank everyone who's taken part, to thank you for listening, and in these troubled times, to wish you all the very best and continued good health. Goodbye.